Hi, my name is Mark Nelson. I am 40 years old. Today is July, 16th today, and it is the StoryCorps booth in Lower Manhattan, and I'm here with my friend Joshua Spafford.
Hi, I'm Joshua Spafford. I'm 35 years old, and I'm with Mark Nelson on that same day. Hey.
Hey. Good to see you again.
Likewise.
This is part five of our discussion about your grandfather, George Hodel. Who, as we've mentioned previously, is become posthumously famous for being a suspect in the murder of Elizabeth Short. The last time we talked, we were talking about Tamar, and you made a point that sort of stuck with me, and I found quite interesting. I think it was a rhetorical point in which you're discussing your sister, and you're saying, you know, she was schizophrenic, schizoaffective. And I think what you're, by relating that to Tamar, you're, I think, making a sort of the point that we all occupy our own truth, basically, that if we're trying to all look at this event, we aren't necessarily all seeing the same thing. I don't think you were implying that Tamar was necessarily ill. I think you were just, correct me if I'm wrong, but...
I'm not correcting you.
Okay, all right. Okay, fair enough. So I thought it was interesting because I think it's a sort of a relativistic point also, meaning it's all relative, mm-hmm. How we approach this. And I think that, this is also the case in the bigger picture of the Black Dahlia murder, but, what I thought would be interesting would be to just have you hear from me what Tamar told me. Simply so that that's that little part of the story is
sure.
Is on record. she says that what happens is she comes home from school, summer school or something, or wherever she was. It's about 3:30 in the afternoon. She comes into the Franklin House courtyard, which, as you know, is this enclosed courtyard that looks kind of like a Mayan temple. And she's called into the back room, the far room from the entrance, which is your father's master bedroom, and that present in the room are Fred Sexton, Corrine Terran, Barbara Sherman, and I think your father. I think I just said that. So there are four people in the room. Now, it's a hot summer California day, and she's asked to join this circle of people, and they're practicing hypnotism, which was quite in vogue at the time. John Huston has a big part in his biography about practicing hypnotism. This is kind of the day, in a way. So they're playing around with that, and then it's hot, so it's suggested that she take off her top, which she does, which, again, and we've talked about this in this kind of libertine circle, that's not that unusual. But then one thing leads to another, and your father suggests that your grandfather suggests that Barbara Sherman have oral sex with her, perform oral sex on her, which she does. At which point, this makes Fred Sexton aroused, and he wants to have sexual intercourse with Tamar. He tries to do that, and that makes your grandfather angry. He pulls Fred Sexton basically off of her, says no, kicks out Barbara Sherman and Fred. And then Tamar says she's not quite sure, she doesn't remember where Corrine was. Did she leave at that time or did she stick around longer? And then your grandfather proceeded to have sexual intercourse with her one time, and that it was a very she felt a shame-ridden experience. And then she didn't think much more of it. It was over. It was done with. And then she went to... A month went by, and she discovered that her period had stopped. She was pregnant by her father. And so she told a friend at school. And then that's how it kind of started to come out. That's how the genie was starting to get let out of the bottle. And the friend said, well, you've got to have an abortion right away. You can't have a child by your father. So she went home and told George that she wanted an abortion. And his first response was no. We'll keep the baby. We'll send you away and you'll have the baby. But then I think in her mind, I think she thinks that reality got the better of him and he decided to arrange for an abortion, which he did with, according to her, with a man named, I believe, Francis Ballard and his assistant, Charles Smith. So in trying between the two of us to finish up the discussion of Tamar, which has now been going on for a few months between us, the story is interesting to me because of this reason. In order for Tamar to be lying, you would have to believe that Fred Sexton, Barbara Sherman, and Corrine Terran, three adults who gave statements to the police, were lying. Then you'd have to believe that Barbara Sherman, who gave the statement to the police that the sex acts had occurred but then took them back, was not lying in her recantation. Then you'd have to believe that George Hurdell was lying because he incriminated himself to the police the next day. It's quoted in the newspaper as such. That Tamar is lying because she made the whole thing up. That she invented two doctors that could have performed this abortion, a doctor and his assistant, Charles Smith, that could have done this. And then you would also, skipping forward all the way in time, way after the event, have to believe that Lillian Lenorek was lying when she said that she wasn't there for the abortion, when she said that she was there for the abortion, and that Joe Barrett was lying when he said that the trial reached an acquittal because of the payoff. So that's like 10 adults and very different, over a very great span of time, several months, all providing a different angle on the same situation that you would have to believe are lying. So I just wonder, you know, I guess what I'm saying is I've come to a sense of something real happened here. At some point, all relativism aside, a crime is a crime. It's a simple fact. The Black Dahlia was murdered. We can all take our relative sides about that, but somebody did it. I'm not saying your grandfather did it. I'm just saying somebody did it. That's a fact. And I think this would be the hardest thing for a prosecutor, you know, like, I think I'd make a terrible prosecutor because I can see gray, shades of gray inside shades of gray inside shades of gray. And I can empathize with you when you provide an argument like the schizoaffective argument. So I wondered if, I don't have a question here as much as I wanted you to understand how I came to believe the Tamar story. I just mean that there's so much you have to disbelieve.
I think we're very similar in that I would also make a terrible prosecutor because I embrace all those shades of gray and I embrace the ambiguities and the multiple perspectives of viewing an event, even when they implicate something not so good. You know, I guess if my family were to make a comment on me, both sides, meaning let's just call it the pro and anti-George sides, mm-hmm. meaning my immediate family and my...
You mean when you're playing devil's advocate with them, for example?
Yeah, is that I'm willing to entertain ideas that support that he might have either had incest with Tamar and or committed the murder. Mm-hmm. I'm not necessarily saying that he did that, but I'm saying I'd be willing to look at that idea for a moment. So like you, I can hop on both perspectives.
The problem
with having that ability in this particular circumstance is that I feel awful for saying this, but the act of a single act of incest, you know, which is a terrible and horrible thing which should not happen, but does happen, does not make a hard line equation to making him the Black Dahlia murderer. Now I know that it's another notch in the belt of incriminating behavior, mm-hmm. but if every single little event can be called into question. I was just home recently, and my grandmother, who was at the Franklin House and met George at that time and mm-hmm. got a sense of what was going on, and does not believe that he was a killer. I mean, I pressed her. She's getting very old now. Mm-hmm. And the result of that is I know that I need to get some stories and answers from her quickly. But at the same time, she's also been very open in a way that she never has been. I don't know that she's consciously doing that, but mm-hmm. it's just been kind of flowing out of her.
Can you give any examples
yeah.
of that?
Yeah.
Without you know, getting into the privacy
sure.
issues?
Sure. I'll give you a 1 minute little example. I mean, my grandmother is a religious woman and a politician. She's a two-term congresswoman. Mm-hmm. And her reputation's always been naturally very important to her. She's also a very proud woman. And, like, so things that she would never share in her life that sort of painted her out to be anything less than a virtuous, upstanding, religious woman. I mean, she just said recently, like, oh, well, I said, Grandma, tell me about your first loves. You know, she says, well, I took a trip around the world when I was in my early 20s on a yacht, on a cruise boat. And the captain was in love with me. I said, oh, that's great. He goes, and his son was also in love with me. I said, that's wonderful. And I took them to my hacienda. I'm like, okay. To my plantation. I said, great. She's a plantation owner. And she says, and there we smoked the marijuana. I'm like, really? I mean, that was very out of character for her to say that. She smoked weed in 1930 or whatever it was. But I'm giving a lighthearted example of the fact that she's letting her guard down now. So, but even she will say, look, when I met your grandfather at the Franklin House, and in recalling those days, these are her words. Her words are, mistakes were made.
Right. When you defend the possibility, if you defend it, I wasn't there for this conversation, but if you defend or play devil's advocate to the possibility that incest did occur, how does she take that? Does she get upset by that still?
Yeah, you know, I can't directly spell out to her, I think George might have, or can we entertain the idea for a moment? I can't come out and say it as direct as that. Mm-hmm. I kind of have to speak and careful code and ambiguities, and mm-hmm. well, if I get too close to the subject, it's difficult because, you know, it seems like she's had to negotiate her own relationship and her own understanding of what happened there in order for her to proceed, A, in her immediate marriage in those years that followed, in a divorce, and in her golden years too, and now, and in this event, she must have had a constantly changing relationship to her understanding, with her understanding to that event. Mm-hmm. Like, that's never gone away.
Right.
Murder or no murder, that incest that afternoon and the case that followed, that's been there and is kind of dug in deep.
Yeah.
In her life, and now in her last few years, she has to kind of relive it in a way that everyone's asking her questions.
Right. I think it is important that we separate the two events. They're not the same.
They're totally not the same. They're terrible, but they're not.
In fact, have nothing to do with each other, other than, like I said earlier, when we're looking for a rationale for considering him as a suspect,
right.
We need to look at the behavioral patterns that sure. are going on in the story. So, you know, I want to make sure you understand that I'm not saying that those two things are even vaguely related, other than we're talking about the same man in the same time period, you know, beyond that.
But to me, this is really a fascinating part of looking at this event. And I'm learning a lot about it, too. It's because these things, unfortunately, the way people view the history of this, these events seem incredibly related since they kind of happened near to each other, you know, within a few years. And when I was a kid and people would tell me, oh, your grandfather's house was under surveillance, everyone knew that. That was sort of family lore. I assumed it was something to do with the Tamar case. I don't know, but that case looms so large in our lives that I thought, oh, they're still looking at him somehow. Mm-hmm. I had no clue. I had no clue that this, the reason why they're watching him was not for that case.
For the Black Dahlia murder. Yeah.
That blew me away.
If you don't mind, there's one thing that is, it's from Steve's book, but it's pretty fascinating actually to me, which again goes back to it goes back to this question of Tamar and could she be lying or is she not lying? And it's this interview with I'm sure you've probably read this part. It's the interview with Mildred Bray Colby. You remember who she is? She was a girlfriend of Charles Smith.
Yeah.
And this is Frank Jemison, the investigator, coming to see her to ask her about, well, mostly he really wants to know about George, but he's asking her about Charlie so he can get to George. And he says, you know, basically, did you know Charles Smith? Yes, Smith made, did you know that he was a friend of Dr. Hodel's? Yes, Smith made frequent trips to San Francisco for tea. You know about your grandfather's tea business, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you know that he was operating girls from San Francisco for abortions? Answer, no, but I wouldn't put it past him. Is this a picture of him? Yes, that's him, all right. Smith said, this is her answer, yes, that's him, all right. Smith said that someday he was going to fix Tamar. He was going to cut a chunk out of the calf of her leg and fry it and eat it up in front of her eyes and then puke it out in front of her face. Did you ever hear Smith mention the Black Dahlia? No. Did you ever hear Hodel mention the Black Dahlia? No. The last night I was with Charlie Smith, we went to a show. We got to Hollywood about 2 o'clock, somewhere in Franklin near Normandy. That's where your family house was. He went in the house somewhere after he came out, blah, 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 paraphrasing here, pulled out an envelope that contained at least $1,000 in money. Before he went in, I know he didn't have any money. What date was that? December 29th, 1949. So that's 5 days after the acquittal. His birthday was December 28th. That's how I know. And so on and so forth. What's fascinating to me about that story is, or that interview, is that it's not only that Tamar invented a character, if you want to say that she pulled this guy out of nowhere. She pulled this guy out of nowhere, Charles Smith, who's a real piece of work. You know, it's like, clearly there's enough, clearly he was a friend of your grandfather's. You know, he's operating the tea business with and for him. But, you know, he's obviously grotesquely violent type, you know. And I just think it's fascinating. And again, there's no real question here. I just think it's fascinating that of all the characters she could invent, you know, or pull out of thin air to be this abortionist guy, she picks him. You know what I'm saying? It's another little screw in to me. And you can't just make up a guy like Charles Smith. You know, she's a 14-year-old girl. She can't make up someone that ugly and violent. It's a way of saying, what I'm saying is, for me, it's another way in which I believe Tamar, mm-hmm. is all. So, you know, I mentioned I wouldn't make a great prosecutor. I laid out a sort of a 10-adult scenario for why I do believe her, why if I were prosecuting the case today, I would say, look at this, you know, parabola with Tamar at the top of it and,
right,
you know, all these other adult characters, you know, flanging on the sides of it. You know, when you hear me lay out an argument like that today, mm-hmm. maybe you feel differently tomorrow, but what's the response today? I know you go back and forth on this.
No,
issue.
I do, but my response to it. It actually, I don't have a response, but what it does to me is it just confirms the possibility that that George did have incest with Tamar. I mean, that to me is a very real possibility. Mm-hmm. And I've never really bought the story that this is just a huge, ornate lie when so much has been pointing towards it. But I can never look at that event by itself. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe when I was 14 or so, and your grandfather tells you that's a lie, you go, oh, okay, that's a lie. But as you grow up and then you hear that, but now these stories, they don't come alone. They're in tandem with other stories. And I have to look at his behavior before and after and the choices he made afterward. He fled the country and didn't essentially come back and started the new life and was very secretive and private. And I guess what I'm saying is, I hear that, and all I can do is try to put things in perspective, because the chances are is he it is quite possible that he had some kind of sexual relationship with Tamar. I don't disbelieve that, but I can't now look at this event alone. I mean, because we're here because the Black Dahlia exists, or right. It does not exist. And it's just this weird sort of Chinese lock. What do you call those little knots? And that, well, just because he was terrible in that way doesn't mean he was one notch terrible higher.
Right. No.
And it's the weirdest quandary to start to try to... what's the word I'm looking for? Put value on being terrible? Like, what's worse? What's a worse monster? A father having an afternoon of incest one event one time, or which is god awful? Is that equal to the awfulness of chopping someone up?
Yeah.
It's
for myself.
I don't want to come across defending incest.
No, I know. I think you're coming to terms with your grandfather. It's, you know, I'm putting you in an awkward position.
No,
here. I'm saying.
I think it's a really fascinating quandary to speak about. Terrible. Yeah.
Well, just so you know, I have an ever-changing relationship to this material. I sometimes, not always with the incest trial, but with all of it, like with the picture that's been painted. You mentioned last time that Steve's quite clever in terms of how he told his story. I think very carefully, and I've thought for a very long time about how information can be tweaked, changed, you know, to make it sound just the way you want it to sound.
And also, when you present a bit of information surrounded by other go signals, you know, it's the context which makes you see things. It is.
But in the case of Tamar and the argument that I'm laying out here with the 10 different adults,
right.
What I think there's something less tangible going on, which is you couldn't present this in a court of law and expect the judge to buy it lock, stock, and barrel. But I don't know who said it, some detective novelist or something like Raymond Chandler said something about how you can't bury a crime. It just keeps bubbling up. As long as there's someone there to be watchful of that. And you could look at this whole situation, the incest trial, the murder, all the other things we've talked about, as some kind of bizarre Oedipal / Electra complex thing going on. That'd be one way to read into this, you know, Steve and Tamar destroying the mother and the father figures. But I think there's something a little bit more to it than that. It's here I am, a kid from Minnesota, you know, 60 years after the fact. I just happened to look into it for whatever, God knows what reasons I did. And we're still talking about it. You know what I mean? And I'm not saying that makes him a criminal. I realize there's no, like, Monica Lewinsky jism on the dress, you know. It's not like the proof is, the DNA is there or anything, but the essence of the fact that this thing won't die, that it's taken on this huge life, I gotta think that there's something to that. What it is, I can't quantify it. I don't know.
Excuse me, I know that you all, this is like the fifth time you all have come together to talk about this, but they're just, it's very difficult for me to follow it. So, Tamar is your aunt. Steve is your uncle. George is your grandfather. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Those were all nods, by the way.
Well done.
That was good, actually.
That's really good.
Well, you know, for what it's worth, I think that for me, I guess that in a way we've talked about Tamar. I think we've talked about Tamar to the extent that we can, where we're going to come to any kind of... We've both stated some opinions on the Tamar situation over the course of these many tapes. I don't think we can belabor that point a lot longer. We've talked about many things with regard to the criminality, in quotes, that Sarah and I used to come to terms with, presenting him as an okay suspect.
Yeah.
One of the most famous, we talked about this a little bit before we started today, one of the most famous quotes on the DA transcripts is the quote where he says, "Supposing I did kill the Black Dahlia." So what I thought would be pretty fascinating would be to look at that quote in a number of different ways.
Let's look at it.
Because like everything, it presents not an answer but a gray area. And I think it's important for people to understand that. We, of course, use it epigrammatically in our book because it's provocative, and what are you going to do when you've got a quote like that? But let's take a more close look at it. These are from the... this is a quote from the district attorney transcripts that were...
Where is it?
...recorded when your father was... grandfather was under investigation for the murder of Elizabeth Short. And it's a pretty provocative phrase, but depending on how you read it, it actually... You can twist that with language to say whatever you want it to say. So I thought we could take a couple stabs at it.
Well, first of all, the quote is, "Supposing I did kill the Black Dahlia. They couldn't prove it now. They can't talk to my secretary anymore because she's dead." That's what the quote is by itself.
And that is in quotation marks. However, it's very important to read it carefully because it's in quotation marks, but it's not a transcript of something that's on tape. It's being written down by the person listening. So we're one step removed from an actual transcript of a recording.
This is not the transcript.
This is the investigator's log.
Right.
So he's writing down what he's hearing, and they're recording it. So, and I think there might be some problem where they're not quite up and running with the spools yet, so...
Yeah, it says right afterwards, as stated heretofore, conversation was garbled. Mm-hmm. And it was difficult to maintain a line of continuity of conversation.
Okay, so that's important, right? That changes, again, how we read that phrase. So I thought what we could do is just read it. You're an actor, right?
Sure.
Maybe you could read it like he's guilty of sin.
"Supposing I did kill the Black Dahlia. They couldn't prove it now. They can't talk to my secretary anymore because she's dead."
Okay, maybe you could read it a little differently, maybe with a rhetorical, "Yes, I did it," to mean really, "Of course, no, I didn't."
"Supposing I did kill the Black Dahlia. They couldn't prove it now. They can't talk to my secretary anymore because she's dead." You see, even just between those two, there's so many situations.
Right, you could go on ad infinitum.
You could go on forever. And there's also you could read it that he knows he's being listened to. He could be playing with people. He could find it ridiculous that he's being bugged and under surveillance, and he could be, which is a natural reaction. If somebody's spying on you, you could play with them, and you could say something like, you could play it up and play the monster.
Ham it, yeah, okay.
So, you know, it could be like, "Supposing I did kill the Black Dahlia. They couldn't prove it now. They couldn't talk to my secretary anymore because she's dead."
Tap, tap, microphone.
Exactly.
Yeah. I would disagree with that point only because, that last point, only because there are at least five or more incidences later in the tape where he's later on the transcripts where he's telling people, "Shh, be quiet, you can't talk on the phone." He thinks his phone is being
tapped. His phone, but not the house.
He doesn't know that, I don't think he knows at this point that his house is being bugged. I don't think so.
Right.
Because later... He keeps talking about how people have to call him back at different numbers, or he has to go outside to make phone calls because his phone is tapped. And it doesn't sound like something you say when you're... It doesn't sound like a game you're playing if you believe your phone is tapped. That's not to say he didn't know it. I'm just saying, you know.
It's interesting. That's a good...
So the question for me here is not really even the Black Dahlia again. The question that's more interesting to me is how a few minutes later on the tape he says... Hodel, this is 10 minutes later, I think. Hodel talking to a man with an accent, possibly German. Telephone men were here. Operator, realized there was nothing I could do but put a pillow over her head and cover her with the blanket. Get a taxi, call Georgia Street Receiving right away. Expired at 12:39. They thought there was something fishy. Anyway, now maybe they figured it out. Killed her. Maybe I did kill my secretary. They must have enough. And this is... But again, that's not him quoted. That's the officer taking that down. And then he puts his own injection in there. He says, he interjects with, they must have enough on him to be guilty or he wouldn't have confessed. But the thing that is interesting for me here is not the Black Dahlia. The thing that's interesting for me here is, why is he bringing up Ruth Spaulding, the secretary? I don't know the answer to this question. Why is he bringing up the death of a secretary who died in 1945 under also suspicious circumstances? In relation to the Black Dahlia, I don't know what to make of that. I don't know why you'd put those two things together like that. I don't know if that means that the police were pestering him about Ruth Spaulding, and therefore that's why those two things are jammed together. I don't know. I don't know that it's. I don't know that he's really confessing to the Black Dahlia murder here. Like I've always said, I still don't know that I've ever found anything that makes me think, oh yeah, he did it. It could be a rhetorical. Of
but
course
it
I
is
didn't.
Odd that he brings up
the secretary, yeah. And so what is the relationship? Is there a relationship? There are a lot of other, you know, reasons why George should be looked at carefully as a suspect. One of them is that Elizabeth Short, in the last days of her life, for 2 weeks, lived at the Gardien Arms apartment literally two blocks from George. I mean, we're talking about Hollywood, very small community, very sort of defined community. You know, there are a number of smaller points like that that aren't really worth spending lots and lots of time over, since the link between, for example, they went to the same nightclubs. But there's not a lot of concrete business to put the two people together. The secretary's interesting, the comment to the secretary.
Yeah.
I don't think we'll ever get there, you know, but I think it's interesting for you and I to just hash it out, just so that you know that we had a legitimate reason to get where we got.
Sure.
So I think we've gone over the backstory enough, don't you? I mean,
yeah.
We've spent a while on it. Why don't we just skip to something that's interesting, regardless of whether or not the Black Dahlia is involved, which is the Hollywood years and the people that your grandfather was involved with. I mean, you mentioned that it was family lore, the whole relationship to John Huston and Man Ray. And these are fascinating people of the 20th century that he was involved with. A lot of skeptics, I think, for some bizarre reason, don't want to believe that there's this guy who hung out with these other guys. Can you talk a little bit about that from your perspective? Like, did your dad talk about those guys, Man Ray,
sure.
John Huston? How did that come up in the context of when you were growing up?
John Huston, not so much directly from George, but Man Ray certainly. There, he had some of his artwork on the walls, and he had a lot of artwork in his home, and he would just be very proud and point it out. And some reason talking about Man Ray didn't seem to be anything hush hush, but John Huston was kind of another topic. I don't remember why that was growing up.
But I guess let me rephrase that question a little bit.
Yeah.
A lot of people have pictures on their walls by famous artists, and
right.
they point to them proudly. That's my, you know, that's my Cindy Sherman, or that's my whatever, you know,
yeah.
that's my John Baldessari picture there.
Yeah.
But he wasn't pointing to them in that way, necessarily. He was also very proud that he was...
Friends, and yeah.
And that was something you knew. That's not something you discovered in Steve's book.
No.
That was something
no.
that you knew about.
No. We might even have a man ray floating around our own house. I think we do. Came down from him, or a copy, possibly. It was just, you know, now that we look at it, it seems sensational, but at the time it was no big deal. It was just what it was.
Right.
Especially given that George had led such a big life in other aspects, that he was friends with Man Ray was not really a very big deal at all.
Right.
Yeah.
And then John Houston, you know, you told me that, and I think Steve also told me this, I haven't quite wrapped my head around how it could possibly be true, that your father was the inspiration for the evil Noah Cross in Chinatown.
Yeah.
Is that, that's also part of family lore?
Uh-huh.
How so? I mean, this movie was made much later in the 70s.
Who told me this? At this point, you know, when everyone talks about it, I could go back and look at it, try to piece together who started this and mm-hmm. who told me this, but
it's kind of a fascinating aside. It really doesn't point to proving much. It's just kind of fascinating that, because that guy is like one of the, you know, that's played by John Huston, of course.
And it's also played by John Huston.
Right, and it is one of the remarkable movie villains of all time.
Yeah.
And when you place it in the context of your grandfather's story, it has a natural fit.
Yeah.
I just wondered if you knew anything about how that came to be.
I could ask around. I don't know. It's just one of those other things. When you live with this for so long, you kind of need to demonize it somehow and just be able to live with it, you know?
Right.
When it's just one huge story after another, after a while, they
blend together.
They blend together.
Well, if you ever figure it out again,
I'd be happy to. I'd have to think about that.
What was the character's name again?
Noah Cross.
He played the incestuous father to Faye Dunaway. Is that
Faye
right?
Dunaway.
Yeah.
Right.
What's that famous line?
My sister, my mother, my sister, my mother.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay. This is a little bit of non sequiturs. We've only got a few minutes left. You mentioned that you're maybe just to give a little bit more of a portrait of George. I'd like to come back maybe in our next and probably almost certainly our last session here. I'd like to come back a little bit to the Hollywood years and to the amazing community of people that shapes that story, because that's the heart of it right here. From our perspective, from Sarah's and my perspective, is. It ties back to our theory, which is these amazing people that your grandfather was involved with. But I think I'll just change course just for a second, just to build out a little bit more of a picture of your own relationship to George. You mentioned that your uncle Ramon died of AIDS, and obviously your grandfather was still alive at that time. How did he take that? This is just something that popped into my head on the way over here.
I don't know. I've had a really mixed relationship to that event, because I was living with Ramon and helping nurse him those last few years, not few months, sorry.
What year was this, by the way? That was
94, I think. Mm-hmm. 93, 94. And he would talk on the phone a lot with Grandpa, with George, and I would too. And I was living with Ramon in his house on Jane Street, but he was still renting it. But, you know, he couldn't work anymore, so everyone was helping out to pay that rent. But the idea was floated that if George could buy that apartment for Ramon, I could have it when he passed on, and we just all assumed that could easily be achieved. Like, that was a no-brainer. Like, well, he has the money. Mm-hmm. Everyone just assumed that he was the richest man on earth, which I don't know that that's true or not, but, and that didn't happen. He didn't buy the apartment. Mm-hmm. And he didn't go to Ramon's funeral either.
Mm-hmm.
So that was difficult.
Is this a gay thing? Was he unhappy about that?
No, he seemed to indicate no.
He didn't have any of that kind of classic hetero.
No, and I've been reading all their letters recently. They have a ton of correspondence.
Oh, really?
And George's tone to Ramon is extremely warm and supportive. And even before Ramon got really sick, I've been reading their correspondence, and it's also very warm. Very warm in a way that an earlier version
that surprised you, maybe.
Yeah. But Ramon was always very vocal that he had had a really wonderful private relationship with George, and you know, he even styled himself to look like him with his mustache and clothing, and he was very dapper and worldly. And I think Ramon tried to take what little time and goodness and warmth that he did receive from George and really embrace that, because that wasn't the norm with his other kids. But that he didn't buy the apartment for him or show up to the funeral was confusing. And to me, the first time I ever felt, I'm worried to even say slighted, but I, at the time, I was a little hurt. I was like, well, you're very vocal about your affection towards me, and you know that I want to move to New York and start my life here, and it was a difficult thing for me to do from scratch. And
he could have made it easier, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was, and then him not showing. I don't know. I still haven't gotten to the bottom of why he wasn't at Ramon's wake.
Did Hortensia come?
Yeah, she did. She did.
And she was she close to him too, or no?
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is a devastating event in her family. This is terrible. Because Ramon was very much the figure in our family, in the Hodel family, that linked everyone together, who went out of his way to put family reunions together, to negotiate. He's kind of an ambassador.
He was quite high up, wasn't he? Like maybe Amnesty International.
Yeah, he
or
worked
something.
At Amnesty, and he was also a sort of a well-placed figure in the Philippine American circles, sort of a point person. I remember knew him. So that was the first time I ever took a second look at George.
So it was infused with some kind of a little bit of anger then, maybe.
Yeah, and disappointment, certainly. Like, well, why wasn't he there for them?
So do you reckon if that had never... Let's say George's life had ended prior to that, and you'd never had that reflexive moment with the apartment or with Ramon, do you think you'd have a whole different relationship to discussing the possibility of the Black Dahlia?
Slightly. I mean, that event by itself wasn't big enough to... slightly is the answer, because when you have an aunt that you grow up and you can't talk to her or talk about her,
right? I see. And that's so huge.
That's just a huge. Like if we're in a room with four walls and you can't look at the fourth wall, do you know what I mean? Like if something which is so glaringly apparent, if you're not allowed to address it, you realize that something is off from a very young age.
Right.
So that really just permeated a lot. There were just givens that you can't talk about. And after a while, you became used to that.
Yeah.
I don't know how that must sound, but that's how it was.
It's a little... I understand it intellectually.
Yeah.
It's, you know, I grew up in a pretty supportive family, and to be frank, I mean, the problems in your family make ours look really banal. I mean, you know.
I always hear that.
I'm sorry. You know, it's you know, I can
but
only
actually,
say what it is.
To talk about it is very stress relieving. I don't know why. It's just subtly cathartic for me to even... I've grown up all my life, not only with these stories, but with other ones that are very close to me, with the given assumption that I must never speak and I must never divulge. And that wasn't even an issue. It was never, are you going to? But it's always been, you will not. And now I'm realizing that I can talk about what I want to talk about. And it's okay.
Interesting. How are we doing for time? We're done?
We're done.
All right, great. We'll see you next time. I think we'll finish up on the... I think we've kind of agreed that we've got a little more to talk about, and then we'll be done. Right?
Forever.
Forever, yeah. Unless something else happens. All right.